I think we should be very careful about artificial intelligence. If I were to guess at what our biggest existential threat is,
it's second probably is a revolutionary moment.
Bill,
what the breaches in the rocket cylinder that drove its mill? I can give you no authoritative information either to their nature, their origin, or their purposes here on Earth.
Welcome to this great edition of Creative Futurism. My name's John Best.
And my name is Kevin J. Anderson, and we're here to talk about creativity and business and computers and technology and the future and how do we deal with it all. So we've got an excellent guest today, and we'll have some other things to talk about. So let's just get started. John, what I hear you saw a movie a couple of days ago that you liked.
Last night, I want to say I liked it. So I went and saw Ready Player One. I think I've told you before on this show that I was a huge fan. I fell in love with the Ready Player One book when I read it. It's one of the few books I've read maybe four times over the last couple of years. And just, you know, it's a love letter to the era I grew up in, the 80s. And so I went and saw the new movie directed by Steven Spielberg last night. And as I was telling you in the pre-show, I was a bit disappointed. I think the movie itself was really well done, but it's just so far from the book. And the thing that really threw me out, and as you know, I'm a huge Rush fan, your friend Neil Peart, and one of the big premises of the actual book involves Rush and revolves around their 2112 album. And it's not in there. And the thing that really drove me crazy was all the previews and the trailers that you saw, they had Rush's Tom Sawyer playing.
In fact, when Ready Player One was being made, there was a lot of buzz in the Rush fan boards and discussion groups because, 2112 is probably one of Rush's very famous, most famous albums, and it is key to like the climax of the novel. And if they take it out of the movie, well, I guess we'll see a different movie. But you know, we can always say that we read the book and we liked it better than the movie. There's not too many cases where you can say that the movie was better than the book. In fact, I'll throw one out there. I thought Blade Runner was quite a bit better than the Philip K. Dick original novel called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? But, you know, everything's a different take on things. But before you give anything away, I want to go see the movie myself. Although I think the plug that we should be putting in there is the book is truly excellent. Ernest Cline's Ready Player One. In fact, I'm going to throw a different kind of plug in there. I read the audiobook version or listened to the audiobook version, which is read by Will Wheaton, who is a super fanboy himself. And it's possibly one of the best audiobooks as far as the perfect matching of the voice to the material. It's just terrific stuff. And
completely agree.
So anyway, I for myself just came back from a convention in Wales last week.
Wales,
so
I was as in London, Wales in England?
Wales Britain? As in Prince of Wales, England kind of Wales. And I saw lots of castles and
did you go to Stonehenge?
I've been to Stonehenge before. That's in a different part of the country. But
the rocks came from Wales. That's the interesting thing.
We went past where the rocks came from, and saw some of the mountains. We saw Mount Snowdon, which is England's highest or Britain's highest peak, which is nothing like our Colorado peaks, but it was impressive nevertheless. So we'll have to do another episode just talking about, as a science fiction writer going around the world. I've just been invited to a convention in the Czech Republic and another one in Poland. So it's interesting to see fans from around the world. A stormtrooper is a stormtrooper in costume, whether he's in Warsaw or whether he's in Phoenix. So anyway, there are cosplayers, there are conventions, it's comic conventions, superheroes. And in fact, that's probably a good segue to introduce our patiently waiting guest who's listening in on this banter that we're doing.
Yes, yes. I'm super excited to introduce my, I guess, cousin, who I've known, maybe since he was like 12 or 10, maybe?
Yeah, that's probably right around there.
He is an editor at Marvel. His name is Jake Thomas, and he is responsible. And listen to this list, Kevin. Wait till you hear this. The Avengers, Iron Man, Incredible Hulk, X-Men, Captain America, Thor, and the Fantastic Four, He works on Hulk Season 1, Marvel Zombies Destroy, and interestingly enough, and I don't even know what these are, but Marvel Custom Comics. So please welcome Jake Thomas to our show.
Oh, great to be here. I'll clarify a little bit because we were joking earlier about how terrible my LinkedIn page is, apparently. I have worked on all of those books. Currently, I am on the Marvel Street Level books, which is Punisher and Moon Knight and Luke Cage. I've worked on Iron Fist and Black Widow and all those. But right now I'm mostly doing video comics, which is a new thing we're doing that's sort of a link between comic books and cartoons. We're using comic book art with original stories that the artists are doing sort of layered files for, and then we manipulate the artistic layers into something kind of like animation. So I'm forging new ground.
Well, that's perfect for this podcast because we talk about how everything is changing from the arts to technology, and there's a marriage of it right there.
Sure. Yeah.
No, I'm just fascinated, you know, by what you do. You know, I know that I've been involved on his Facebook and his Twitter. He's always posted cool pictures of him and I don't know, Loki, him and a lot of bad guys. I've noticed you seem to be more friends with the villains than you do the superheroes, from what I can tell.
The villains are more interesting.
Absolutely. They've got all the best lines.
Yes.
Yeah. But so Jake, you know, what I wanted to talk about to start off with is, and, you know, I'm just kind of, for me, I'm just trying to understand what's a day in the life of a Marvel editor?
It's at its basic level, I like to think of it sort of as quality control. So what I do is sort of at every step of the process of making a comic book, outside of the actual printing of it, I'm involved in. And so when we first come up with the idea for a book, you know, we'll say, oh, we want to do a new Punisher book or a new Black Widow book. I'll talk with some of the senior editors there and we'll get an idea of like what kind of creator we want on the book, what kind of a feel we want or story we want to tell. So we'll sort of have a general idea of, okay, well, here's what we want to do. And then I'll reach out to writers and artists and say, you know, we're looking to put this book together. Sometimes I'll reach out and just say, do you want to write this book? Or sometimes we'll do something that's called a bake-off, where we'll reach out to a few people and have them pitch. If we don't have a great idea of what we want for the book, but we know we want to do this, we'll reach out to a few people and whoever pitches the most exciting project, we'll bring them on. And so then I'll work with that writer. They'll develop the pitch into an outline. And from the outline, they'll do a script. And at every step of the way, I'm working with them to make sure the story is exciting. It has a good arc. It works dramatically. It fits within the general Marvel universe because our comic books are a shared universe. So they're all hypothetically happening in the same place at the same time. So if I'm working on a Spider-Man book and I want Iron Man to show up, I have to call the Iron Man editor and say, hey, can we have Tony show up in this book? And he either says, yeah, that's great. Or he says, oh, actually, we're sending Tony into space for the next 6 issues. So he's not on Earth anymore. And so then we have to come up with another idea.
Yeah. So all of your books happen concurrently then? I mean, so every issue you pick up has taking place now?
Yes, that's the idea. Obviously, that's extremely difficult. And some days we're better at that than others. But the basic premise is, yeah, we have all of these books happening at the same time. Now, we have a few books that will take place in like a different universe or something like that. But even then, you know, we've got a book right now called Spider-Gwen, which takes place in an alternate dimension where Peter Parker didn't become Spider-Man, but Gwen Stacy did.
Huh, okay.
And so, but the thing is, part of that book involves dimension hopping. And so every now and then, Gwen Stacy will come into our dimension and have coffee with our universe's Spider-Woman, Jessica Drew, and they'll sort of hang out. And she'll meet with our Peter Parker, which is a big deal for her because her Peter Parker and her universe actually became the Lizard and was a bad guy. So she has a lot of very conflicted emotions about Peter Parker. But so when she comes into our universe, she has to come in now you know, or if we have someone go to her universe. So it's a lot of coordination there.
You sound like a total fanboy. Sounds great.
I love it. Yeah, it's great.
So one of the previews I saw last night, so I was mentioning I went and saw Ready Player One. I counted the previews. There were seven of them. And one of them was a new Spider-Man movie where Spider-Man is an African-American young kid. And it's I think it's called like Multiverse or something like that. So is that what you're talking about, is these kind of alternate realities? But there's a scene in there where Peter Parker and him and he goes, how many of us are there? You know,
there's a that's taken from the comic books. In the Marvel universe, there used to be something. We sort of blew it up, but there was something called the Ultimates line of comics. And that started in the early 2000s. And the idea was they were going to start the whole Marvel universe over in a different universe and give it a more modern sensibility. So, and they gave it to a bunch of hip new creators like Mark Miller and Brian Michael Bendis and all these guys, and just sort of had them go crazy recreating the Marvel universe a little different. And so Brian Michael Bendis wrote Ultimate Spider-Man. And of all the Ultimates books, that was the big one. Like, that book really took off, and he wrote hundreds of, I think a couple hundred issues of that. But at a certain point in that book, Spider-Man died. Peter Parker died. And when Peter Parker died, this new kid, Miles Morales, became Spider-Man. And so that Miles Morales character is that character from that preview.
Now, is that Childish Gambino?
It is. Yeah. Yeah. Donald Glover, who I went to NYU with, actually.
Nuh-uh. You're kidding.
Yeah.
You're so cool.
I introduced a one act of his once.
Nuh-uh. See, Kevin, you need to be cool like that. Did you go to school with anybody really cool?
Well, I became really cool, so that's better.
That's true. That is true.
Yeah, you're the guy everyone else is talking about.
Yeah. I went to school with Kevin J. Anderson.
Yeah. And now let me do an equal opportunity thing here, because I have worked for Marvel. I did a whole series of Star Jammers for them, and I've also done some stuff for DC. And DC Comics also has their multiverse, just because they have so many stories that they want to do different directions. So they've got Earth 2 and Earth 3 and Crisis on Infinite Earths, and it kind of got out of hand. So I don't remember what year it was, but the Crisis on Infinite Earths was with the point where they had so many different multiple universes that they couldn't keep track of them anymore. So they wrote a story where they destroyed them all except for one or two, and they've tried to keep it under control a little bit more. So, and in fact, this is one of the things when I was working with, DC invited me to basically pick a book that I wanted to work on. And I did Justice Society, because it was, I always loved those. They were set in the 1940s. So they're like the old Jay Garrick Flash and the old Alan, I'm forgetting his name, the old Green Lantern with the big cape and everything on, and the red. So I wrote that story because I didn't want to walk into the middle of Justice League, where I hadn't read the previous 7,000 issues to know what all the stuff was. And when I did Star Jammers for Marvel, there it's sort of kind of connected to the X-Men, because one of the guys is related to and but they're off in space. In fact, it looks a lot like Guardians of the Galaxy is what it looks like. They're off in space doing something. And in fact, in that mini series that I did, I created these plant-like tree people who were pirates. And somehow it looks exactly like Groot, but that's kind of cool. But the reason that I was able to do that is because they were separate from everything. If I came into work for the X-Men, there'd be so much backstory that I would have to absorb that it couldn't possibly be a feasible job for me to do.
Yeah. I mean, the X-Men's crazy. Of all the Marvel pockets of, you know, universes and stuff, because at the company, there's sort of editorial teams. Like there's an X-Men team and there's an Avengers team and there's a Spider-Man team. And the X-Men team is the craziest because their history is so complicated.
Yeah, because you got time travel people and all kinds of weird stuff, right?
Oh yeah. And just hundreds of mutants and all sorts of different timelines and stuff. Yeah, it's wild.
And if you mess up, like, you get like hate mail, right?
That's... Oh no, the fans never notice.
Oh, they're nice about it. Oh, so you never get yelled at, Jake, is what you're saying. So
yeah.
I picture your office, Jake, like a serial killer's wall or something, like a photo with some yarn connected to Tony Stark, with some more yarn connected to, like, I don't know, some obscure Marvel, you know, character that, like, well, I would have said Luke Cage, but those are coming back. And speaking of that, are you involved in the Netflix remakes of these at all?
No, I've visited the set. I was on set for Iron Fist. And I think that there might be a character in Iron Fist named after me. I think there's two detectives, and I think that they're detectives Thomas and White. And me and another editor at Marvel is a guy named Jordan White. And both of us had gone out to set for that, for Iron Fist.
Nice.
Yeah, so like I know some of the people who have worked on the TV shows and stuff, but we don't tend to get in their way, and they don't tend to get in ours. Like one of the guys who worked on a bunch of the shows, but he would call me for the Punisher show, and like he would ask a question of like, you know, we're trying to work out a scene where Punisher does this or this. Like, has there ever been a scene in the comic where he like set a trap in a door, so when somebody walked through the door, it would set off a shotgun or something, you know? And I would be like, well, I can't remember off the top of my head, but he did this here and this here, you know? Or they would call me up and be like, what was his military rank? Like, how did he come up through the military and all this stuff? So like, they'll check in with me every now and then or ask me a question, but.
So you're like a big Wikipedia for this sort of stuff, like a human Wikipedia.
Kind of, yeah.
Is there a database? Is there like a is there a computer database that, you know, that's internal that, you know, like put in, you know, door trap Punisher, and you know it brings up, you know, all the themes for that.
That computer is a man named Tom Brevoort, who has worked in Marvel for decades and knows everything.
I would have thought it would have been the Stan Lee, but okay.
Well, but there are like wikis that exist, right? I mean, the fans must have put all kinds of these exhaustive things together.
Yeah, there's a Marvel wiki online that I will reference a lot, actually. It's a well done, and I don't even really know who puts it together. I think it's a fan run thing, but it's great. It's extremely comprehensive, and yeah, it's a nice place to go to just if you have that question of like, oh yeah, what is so-and-so's rank or what's so-and-so's eye color? Because eye color is something that I know we screw up all the time.
Yeah. John raised an interesting point about the Netflix series and the other stuff. Now, strictly speaking, the movies and the TV shows are in a different universe than the comics, correct? They're not exactly the same?
Oh, not at all. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you're, it's good that they're trying to keep it accurate on the TV show, but if they get a fact wrong on the Punisher TV show, well, that's a different universe anyway. We have come to accept many kinds of alternative facts when you read comics.
Yeah, that's true.
So Jake, as I remember, you were a Dune guy, right? You and your dad both liked the Dune series, if I remember right.
I don't know that you are remembering right. I just read Dune recently for the first time a couple years ago.
Really? Well, you know, yeah. Did you know that you have, you know, one of the world's foremost experts here on the show who's working on the new movie?
I am aware of that, which is extremely exciting. And here's a question that I have for you, a question I'm sure you get all the time. But I am curious what your feelings are about the David Lynch Dune.
Well, there were two versions before it. There was the David Lynch film from like 1984, if I remember right. And then the Sci-Fi Channel did a 6-hour miniseries adaptation of it, 2006, something like that. I'm terrible with numbers. I can't remember my own phone number usually. But so the David Lynch movie was visually incredible. The imagination, the ships, the scenes, and some of the stuff in there was really great. The soundtrack was great. They had like an amazing cast. I mean, Patrick Stewart playing Gurney Halleck and all some really cool stuff. You can't unsee Sting in a blue codpiece, but it still was a good visual. It was so full of energy and color and imagination, and it got a lot of people reading Dune. It wasn't all that accurate to the novel Dune. They took a lot of liberties with it, but that happens in movies. I mean, we're used to that. So, but I mean, there are a couple of unforgivable things, like at the very end of the David Lynch movie, Paul Atreides makes it rain, and it rains on Dune. And we're all watching this thinking, you've established that water kills the sandworms, so you've just annihilated all of the sandworms, which create the spice, which is what makes the entire galactic empire work. So probably not the smartest thing to do. but it looked good on screen. The Sci-Fi Channel miniseries was much more accurate to the book, plot by plot, and all this stuff. But it was lower budget. It seemed a little lower energy. It didn't have the pizzazz that the Lynch one did. But you know what happens is we've got to now make the Legendary Pictures is now in the process of working on the new Dune film, which Denis Villeneuve, the director of Blade Runner 2049 and Arrival and a bunch of other movies, he's the director on it. And we've got Eric Roth, who won the Academy Award for Forrest Gump, and he also did Benjamin Button and Ali and a whole bunch of other really epic movies. He's doing the script for it. And if it goes, and of course, nothing ever goes until they actually send you the check and it clears the bank. But if it goes, this looks like it's going to be, you know, amazingly by far the best adaptation of Dune ever. And of course, we hope that leads to films of Dune Messiah and maybe House Atreides and some of the other books that we've done. And but one step at a time, and it's Hollywood. So, you know, we believe it when it happens. And I'm, you know, I kind of have a gag order and can't tell any further details until it gets announced. And in fact, I usually, when something's announced, I find out about it when all the fans start forwarding it to me to say, is this true? You deal with that at Marvel. I'm sure you know all sorts of things about who's going to surprise die in the next issue or who's going to be in the next movie of this or TV show, and you can't talk about it. So we just have to sit there and smile with this little knowing look on our face and going, if only you knew.
Yep.
Speaking of that, so, you know, the Avengers Infinity is Infinity Wars is coming out, and Jake, you usually go to the premieres of those, right? Like all you Marvel guys get together and, I don't know, go somewhere special. I've seen your pictures on Facebook. Have you seen it yet?
No. It's usually the same week as it opens. We'll go. They'll do it a couple days early. I am sadly going to miss this one. Emily and I are going to be in Disney. We're taking a nice vacation. So
hopefully you get some sort of discount for being a Marvel employee.
I do. Wow. Which is nice. We are considered company members. So I actually worked at the park one summer in high school. So
did you? Which one? Orlando or California?
Orlando. I stayed with my grandfather because he lived in Sanford. And I worked there over the summer at the what was then the Disney MGM theme park. I was a tour guide. So I took people through the backstage pass, which has not existed for years now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You get to go see. I did that once. You get to go see, like, they have the Star Wars back there. They had like the Triceratops from Jurassic Park that you could, you know, look at the actual whatever it was, the old a bunch of stuff back there, right? If I remember right.
That was one of the other ones. This one was where you get to see the operational sound stages.
Oh, yeah, never saw
like that. Three working sound stages, and they also had at the front like Jim Henson Creature Shop exhibit and stuff. So
nice.
They had a thing where you could demonstrate green screen and everything.
One time I was wandering through there, and some guy came up with a clipboard and said, "Do you want to be on Let's Make a Deal?" And I said, sure. And next thing I know, I was dressed in a bunny suit, making a decision between like two boxes, and I won like a case of Twinkies. And that was the whole thing, really.
And I bet they're still edible too.
Oh, they are. They'll be good for a long, long time. They're like, what is it? Water bears, right? They're like tartisans. They'll be around forever. So Jake, just to kind of close this out, and I really appreciate you joining us. If someone's interested, like, you know, I'm betting that there'll be just lots of people listening to this going, man, comic books, I love them. I love the stories. And this goes to you too, Kevin. You know, Kevin, obviously you've written for them. How'd you wind up at Marvel? You know, did you wander in there and go, give me a job. I'm not leaving until you give me a job, or this is Stan Lee's underwear. I could show it to everybody. What'd you do? How's this happen?
I actually got in through theater. There's a lot of theater people at Marvel. I had, when I was in college, I did a lot of theater stuff with a guy named Sean Ryan, who worked at Marvel a little bit, and then went to DC and then went out west to Hollywood. And when he was out in LA, he heard that they were looking for people at Marvel to come in as assistants. And he was actually the guy who turned me on to comics. I had never read comics as a kid. I started reading them in college.
Wow.
And so, you know,
Kevin, he's a pastor's son. So, you know, picture the whole Footloose kind of a thing. He wasn't allowed to dance. It's a whole big thing, but go ahead.
I never knew, like, I never knew if we had a comic shop anywhere we lived. I wish I'd gotten into them earlier because they're fantastic. But so he called me and said, hey, would you be interested in working at Marvel? And I was at the front desk at the Columbia Student Center at the time. So I was like, yes, I would like to work at Marvel, please. Mm-hmm. I'll let people there know if you want to send in your resume. I'll just make sure that somebody looks at it. So I sent my resume in, and then they had me do a couple of test edits on scripts and things. So I'd have to read these scripts and go through and give notes and all that kind of stuff so they could make sure that I knew what I was talking about. But that's one of the reasons they actually like theater kids, because we've had a lot of experience, breaking down stories, doing story analysis, and working visually as well. Most people, if you're in theater, you've designed sets at some point, you've worked on stage pictures, you've, you know, worked on clarity of movement and all that kind of stuff. So we sort of have a lot of the editorial skills baked in, and we're also obviously people, because a lot of this job is dealing with all of the different artists and writers and all that stuff. So you have to be able to handle a lot of crazy stress, work on a wild schedule, get something done, and not make people hate you.
Well, you were doing some pretty interesting things before that, though. Like, I remember, I think, seeing a play or something, like Vonnegut play that you'd done or something, or Vonnegut was there. I forget, but I know.
Right at the end of college, I was in a theater company where we did a show. We did Kurt Vonnegut's show, Happy Birthday, Wanda June. We actually got him to come and talk to us while we were doing the show. And then he came and did a talk back opening night. And he was actually a real sweetheart. I hung out with him a few times afterwards. He was very open about, you know, he loved that play, and he was very excited that we did it because it hadn't been done. I don't know if it had been done in New York since it premiered in the 70s. So he was just thrilled that we did it and said, you know, whenever you're in my neck of the woods, feel free to stop by. So I did a lot. He was my hero. So.
Well, that's kind of neat. It had never occurred to me that theater people might be connected to comics, but the choreography of moving people and characters on the panels and your familiarity with scripts makes it an obvious thing. I just had never thought about that before. So,
People are way more desperate than film people. So
film people can be pretty desperate. So that's,
I know. Think about that.
Yeah. And so I guess to boil it down, if somebody's listening and decides that they want to work for Marvel Comics, the way to do it is not to write their own Spider-Man script and mail it in and say, please read this. Do you suggest maybe they should try to make connections at like New York Comic Con or San Diego Comic Con or something? Or because I know a lot of the staff goes to those things.
Yeah, that stuff certainly helps. But the biggest thing of all, the one thing you have to do is make stuff. And that's if you want to work in editorial or if you want to write or draw or whatever. You know, we don't hire anyone who hasn't made something. Yeah. You have to show that you can do the work and get things done. And so that's why, you know, again, like for theater people, if you're a theater person who's produced a bunch of shows, they know, oh, okay, well, if you tell this guy we need this done and we need it done by X day, he's put a show up, he's put, you know, a sketch troupe together, he's done this or this or this, cool. Or the same thing with if you're a writer, you have to have something published. And you can even publish it yourself, but to just, if you've published it yourself, that shows that, you know, this person, she can get writing done, she can keep herself on a schedule, she can follow something through and deal with all of the headaches that come with that. So you have to make something.
Sounds like maybe I should try for a different career, because this writing books is getting hard. So I'm going to, maybe I'll be the coffee boy at Marvel. It sounds like lots of fun. I'll swoop in, I'll get my superhero costume on and go. But I've always been a comic fan myself. And I really, I grew up reading comics, and that was, I lived in this little tiny town in Wisconsin, and for a kid with an imagination, this was a place where nothing imaginative ever happened. And so I got my escape by reading X-Men back when Wolverine had his big yellow suit, and when Cyclops had his, basically looked like he was going scuba diving, and I read all of those, and I read the Iron Mans and Spider-Mans way back when. So I grew up with it, and I admire what you're doing too. I heard your list of the books that you worked on. I don't know if you've done anything that anybody's ever heard of, but it sounded pretty decent. Yeah.
Well, I could say from experience, he's a very talented dude, and I'm glad to have him in our family. And I've enjoyed working with him. I had some fun. He wrote, actually, and maybe I'll find this, but he wrote a script for us back when I started my podcast, Kevin. We did a drama, and I wanted this kind of day in the future where, like, the technology all goes well for one person, but all goes horrible for another. And of course, the person it goes horrible for is me. And my partner, Tom, is the person it goes well for. And Jake is, I think, 16 voices in it, along with some other really incredible voice talent. I think I'll resurrect that and post it in the link here, because I thought it was just great writing. And then the other piece is, one day I got a burr that I really wanted to write this serial, like, imagine there was a division of the FBI that totally just dealt with clown serial killers, and and the serial killer himself, or the FBI guy, was like a clown. Like, he would show up dressed as a clown, and I said, Jake, you gotta take and write this and run with it. And he wrote this incredible short story that it's still it haunts me, because it was there was an arc in it that was really dark, that I couldn't even put words to. It was just great writing. So maybe I'll dig that up and post it as well on our site, just because they're unknown works of Jake Thomas. But Jake, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. And I'm sure you and Kevin, I hope you guys keep in contact. You're probably at a lot of the same one of these comic cons and things like that. It would be wild to see you two work together. I'm sure that would be fun. But thanks again for joining us. And we hope to have you on again sometime soon.
Yeah. And thanks. It's great to meet you, Jake. John talks about you all the time, usually without rolling his eyes, but he's very excited.
It's
about
true. It. All right. Thanks so much. That's us for Creative Futurism, and we'll catch you again.
You've been listening to Creative Futurism with Kevin J. Anderson and John Best. For more information, go to creativefuturism.com. Thank you.